Chip, let me start with hopefully a question that is both large enough but also focused enough on what you have been exploring over a good many years now. I'm very interested in your use of science fiction. First, how did you get to choose for this narrative mode at the very beginning, and then what interesting uses you found along the way? I'm particularly interested in what political and poetic uses you found in science fiction, because you've obviously pushed the conventions and undermined sort of even the language of traditional science fiction mode. So why science fiction?
I really don't have an answer for that. It just kind of happened. I never decided, oh, I want to be a science fiction writer. The story, which I've told many times, my wife, Marilyn Hacker, was got a job at Ace Books as an assistant editor and would come home usually pretty disgruntled with the stuff she'd been working on all day. I began writing a novel while I was at home for her. Her particular complaints about the material she was working with included the tendency of the female characters to sit around and get rescued constantly without ever doing anything else, and the corresponding over-maleness of the heroes. So finally, I decided to write a novel where the main character was a poet, and the young lady who got rescued turned out to be pretty feisty in spite of it. After I'd gotten about a third of the way through it, and she was sort of reading it every night when she came home, and she said, "You know, this is pretty good. You should submit it." And I said, "Oh, come on. This is basically just an in-joke between you and me." And she said, "No, really, you should." I finished it. She took it in and told the editor-in-chief, Don Walheim, that she'd found it in the slush pile. We put a pen name on it, Bruno Calabro. Where we'd gotten that name, I sometimes wonder. But he read it and liked it, and so he bought it and contracted for it. And after the contracts were drawn up, Marilyn told him, "Oh, that's my husband, incidentally." And he said, "Well, I'm awfully glad of that because I hate the name Bruno Calabro." So I went back to being Samuel Delaney, and the book came out. And because I had sold a novel, I just decided, well, maybe I should write another novel in the same genre as the one I sold. And when I got through three, going on four, science fiction novels, one day it occurred to me, oh, I must be a science fiction writer. But I never made a decision to be a science fiction writer. That just happened.
Retrospectively, what are some of the advantages of this mode for
There are no particular
yeah.
advantages to science fiction, and there are no particular disadvantages to science fiction. It is simply a genre like any other. Genres don't solve problems, they don't create problems. I think all of us would like them to. You're a marginal writer working in a marginal genre. Doesn't that mean that the stories you write will be therefore more sympathetic to marginal people? No. If that's what you're interested in and you can write things like that, then they will be. And if you can't, they don't. There are some very, very conservative science fiction writers, the Heinleins, the Jerry Purnells, the Orson Scott Cards. Just because it's a marginal genre doesn't mean that their ideas are not very straightforward conservative, political ideas. It's the same kind of, what Gilbert Ryle called a category mistake. When you see a beautiful painting of a sunset and you think, ah, maybe there is some mystic relation between paint and sunsets. No, there isn't. Somebody who can paint well will paint a nice sunset. Somebody who can't will paint a not very interesting sunset. You have to be a good practitioner. The genre will not do the work for you.
Antonia Nelson talking about the difference between prose poetry and the short story. And she said, what doesn't interest me is the difference between these lines of genre or what they're. Well, what's interesting is that the writers of one genre, what they have to give up, poet has to give up in order to write in the sort of prose poem, and what the fiction writer has to give up to write short. When you moved to things like autobiography, did you find yourself having to give up things? Did you find there was a struggle?
I wasn't particularly aware of anything being given up. I think, really, for me, nonfiction is just another mode of fiction where you're just a little bit more rigorous about, creating a parallel with things that happen. And, in fiction, if you're writing what most readers recognize as realistic fiction, you have to keep up a parallel between things that happen or could happen, which, on the one hand, is a very broad category, but it's not a category, it's not a wide open category.
One of the things that fascinate me in science fiction, particularly more experimental science fiction, is the encounter with the otherness. Mm-hmm. Just wondering to what extent, I mean, I know that that's a very important concept to you also. So all these encounters with outsiders, the artist as an outsider, mythologized others, aliens and so on. I mean, do you see a particular power or enabling position in the position of the outsider or this position of liminality, or do you see also limitations to this position?
The outsider has a particular point of view, and it is limited, as does the insider have a particular point of view that is equally limited. Sometimes it is even more limited, but every point of view has its limitations. You know, there is no place you can stand without having half the world be behind you, and that's the half you don't see. I think the interest in that comes much more from the kind of life I've led rather than from the genre I've chosen to write in.
What about the relationship between the politics of theme and the poetics of form? Do you even consider this kind of dichotomy useful? A lot of debates in particularly more radical forms of fiction, for example, in feminist fiction, whether postmodern innovative modes are useful or not. You know, sort of effort to defend realism as a mode, as an important mode. The argument was that if you have a radical theme, a revolutionary theme, the form will take care of itself.
The form never takes care of itself. We would all be much happier if it did.
So in that sense, I mean, clearly you are not satisfied with that kind of dichotomy and that sort of split between, well, you have a revolutionary form and you can use the traditional modes of fiction. So what is the relationship between poetics in that sense and politics?
Well, I had been speaking before in the group that I was talking about before, but the granularity that you have to work, that you have to use in order to work these things. And most of the poetics, most of the politics, the political reductions come out of cliches that are not where the corresponding reality is not looked at with the proper granularity, with a high enough grain on the grid, so that easy explanations are, you know, usually easy explanations, and what is easy about them is that they are, you know, ordained by God or nature, or they don't need to be questioned. They're not caused, they're just the way things are. And those are the things that tend to produce the conservative view.
Which compromises, obviously, whatever revolutionary ideology you may have, if you don't. Finally, and then I'll let Nathan try a few questions. What has happened the last decade or so? Why this whole pressure on writers to go back to well-established realistic modes? Maybe when you look at, for example, the difference between the Columbia history of the United States and the Columbia history of the novel. And it's amazing, sort of, there's 3-4 years of difference between the two books. And one still is pretty open-ended, various voices talk about avant-garde, talk about postmodern innovation, etc. The other one, totally closing down the avenues, particularly of experimentation at narrative and linguistic level. And I remember the Ed Cohen essay, for example, on gay fiction. I mean, with the exceptions of you, and I forget if there's anybody else who has actually done any work at the level of language, the essay basically promotes a pretty conservative kind of agenda in terms of narrative. So what is the pressure? Why is the establishment so afraid of narrative innovation?
The establishment I can't speak for. I don't know why they do the strange things that they do. I don't think, and I never have felt, that normative fiction was exhausted. I'm also, as a reader, I'm a great lover of experimental fiction and new forms. I enjoy them. I'm one of the few people who, you know, seems to get a charge out of picking them up, paying money for them, taking them home, and actually reading them. Myself, I don't see a fundamental difference between the two, which is to say, I think all fiction is a matter of observation, representation, and then formal arrangement of these representations. And in different kinds of fiction, the formal arrangement is different. and the intensity of observation is different. And those are two variables that you change. And you can make a complete grid where any piece of fiction from the most far out experimental to the most normative can be plotted on this grid, and something can fall anywhere between it. And I like to read things that fall all over the grid. I think the forms of normative fiction have the potential of talking about pretty much anything. And they don't. Again and again, they don't. I think lots of forms of experimental fiction have the potential of talking about pretty much anything, and most of it doesn't either. When it does, I'm a happier reader than I am when it doesn't. And that, again, pertains to the normative, and it pertains to the non-normative. That's just a statistical lean of what people are having more to do with what people are used to. And indeed, certainly in the academy, more and more people are becoming used to the non-normative. I don't see anything necessarily good or bad about either of these situations. I think, provisionally there are things you can say about all of them. It would be nice to see more of this, more of that. You'd like to see a larger non-academic readership enjoy some of the experimental things, and I would like to see the academic readership get more into some of the normative stuff, which they don't. But these are relatively contingent phenomena. Now, having said this, when I talk to a couple of my literary friends in the more non-normative areas, they are not terribly happy with my theoretical approach. I once was having this discussion with an experimental writer, Richard Castellanos. I presented it pretty much the way I presented it to you, and I said, well, okay, now what do you think I've left out? And he said, everything of interest about experimental fiction. And I think he's right, but I'm approaching it from the point of view of a reader, not the point of view of a practitioner. And his point, for instance, was that experimental writing is largely about extremes. It's largely about parasitism. And for him, parasitism is not a bad word, as intertextuality is not a bad word for people talking about more normative fiction. But the way I tend to put it all, I think this is the influence of Foucault, produces this vast grid on which everything can be plotted. And once you have plotted the grid, you're not left with anything with too much articulation or any, rents and what have you, which may mean that for a certain kind of questioning mind, of the sort of questions that you're asking, there just aren't any answers. There aren't any answers that somebody from my position can give, because it's all been homogenized onto my grid there.
On the other hand, if you look at how the culture is actually policing this grid, you have a very different story.
Right. Yes. But I think it's always false to the individual artist to do something that escapes the surveillance of the police. I think there's a lot of correspondences between the criminal and the artist. They're the two people who force the society to change.
Last night you talked about the sort of etymology of the term coming out, and also its potential possibilities in the future. I'm curious about your views of Eve Sedgwick's The Epistemology of the Closet, how that sort of fits into your ideas.
I basically think that Eve is one of the good people in the world, and is doing something good. There are places where I can't go into them now, because it would just, would require three-hour seminars, where I do have disagreements with her, and they have to do largely with the functioning, the nitty-gritty functioning of sex. I don't know, I may be a bit more sympathetic with a more classical psychoanalytic approach, perhaps, than she is. And I've certainly never gotten a chance to argue it face-to-face with her. And I see her as somebody who's fighting the good fight and, go out there and do it. The distinctions between my feelings and her feelings, I think, are probably much more minor than they may not even be productive to. When all is said and done, I probably have more problems with Judith Butler than I do with Eve Sedgwick. Well, I have problems with everybody. There's nobody I agree with 100%. I think that's the curse of thinking in the contemporary world.
She mentioned similar things about the sort of proliferation of the use of, everybody is using the closet or coming out, things like that.
Although that, I rather like the way she uses it.
Yesterday afternoon at Virginia Union, you read from a story in which a character said something like, "I'm originating from everywhere."
Yes.
And many of your characters, in fact, seem to sort of originate from many sources or transform beyond what we expect sort of a character in a novel to do. Could you talk a little bit about the origin of that idea in your reading or your life? And also, is that something that you've sort of consciously constructed, or is it, like you were saying earlier today, sort of an inevitable outcome of focusing on something else in the writing?
Well, the idea is just a standard theoretical notion, which was one of the major insights, I think, at the beginning of the literary theoretical tsunami that washed across the campuses and through the halls of academe in the late 60s to the middle 70s, that the origin is always a political construct. The notion of a single origin is always a political choice. Things do not have one cause. Things are caused by an entire multiplicity of things, and the one you choose, this is the one I'm going to say is originary, that's always a political decision. You know, that's always a decision, that's always a strategic decision. As such, it's always problematic and always questionable. And Louis, the character who comes to this decision back in 1923, comes to it as people, you know, back to Spinoza, you know, have been coming to it. It's not a new idea. Its most recent articulation has been just at the beginnings of theory, you know, with Edward Said's Beginnings, Intentions, and Method. It was one of the first books that explored this whole thing. And as he says, you got to begin somewhere. You have to pick an origin, but you don't have to accept the origin that everybody else accepts.